From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. It's been a week since the shootings in Orlando. Memorials to honor the dead have been placed in front of Pulse nightclub and also all across the country, including Georgia. Today, we speak with a psychologist about what motivates hate crimes. Then we learn about the tragic life of one woman who inspired the Triumph of Peace statue in Piedmont Park in Atlanta.
On her 40th birthday, her mother had her committed to a lunatic asylum. She had become increasingly paranoid. She had become increasingly agitated. And so the most perverse present from a mother to a daughter on her 40th birthday was to commit her to a lunatic asylum.
That's coming up this hour. First, though, last week we talked about a dating site for Trump supporters. That was in the break room. And we asked our guests whether they would date someone from the opposing political party, and they all had different responses. Here's Savannah Magazine editor and environmental writer Ken Edelstein.
In the past, I've often dated men from the other political parties, but I have to say that if I were in the dating pool right now, it would give me pause because it would really talk about value systems in a much deeper way.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, it's the question of the shared values, but I mean, I don't know. I have friends who are Republican, and some of my best friends are Republican. And I mean, but the thing is, the question is, like, how far? Because I think, you know, the whole Trump thing, it's like, I look at that.
You're separating Trump out from Republican.
Right.
Okay, so that was also the voice of Savannah Magazine editor Amy Condon, along there with Ken Edelstein. Here are your first thoughts. Kim K tweets, "I would not date anyone who is voting for Trump. Just no." Robert Grizzle says, "I'm blessed with a woman more conservative than me. Dating outside your party is trouble." GPB Savannah's Cindy Hill had another perspective. She writes, "For me, it was harder to date someone apolitical than it would be to date someone from a different political party." And Neil Cassidy took a very diplomatic approach with his comment, "Love conquers all." We love hearing what you think. Would you date someone from the opposing political party? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. I'm an independent. I don't know what the opposing political party is of that. Anyway, hospital rooms in Orlando still house victims of last Sunday's shooting at the Pulse nightclub. 49 people were killed, 53 injured. The shooter also died. But many questions remain about why it happened and whether we could prevent it from happening again. Two nightclubs in Atlanta have already been threatened over social media, and Atlanta's chief medical examiner has decided to expand the city's morgue in case of a similar attack. My first guest says to understand the tragedy in Orlando, you have to understand hate. Ari Kuglansky studies that particular emotion and the way it affects the brain. He's a distinguished professor of psychology at the University of Maryland and joins us now. Good morning, Ari.
Good morning.
So, is hate a scientific term? Does that describe something that we can actually track and test for?
Hate is an emotion that can be expressed in people's attitudes, and as such, it can be very well recorded and studied.
How do you separate hate from just anger?
Hate has a specific target. Hate is against somebody specific. Hate of others usually comes from hate of one's own self derives from one's humiliation, one's loss of sense of significance and mattering, and this is then displaced onto others perceived as the culprit of one's suffering.
So is hate always a concern? Is in psychological terms, is hating someone or something always a matter of concern?
It is always a matter of concern because it can develop into violence. It can develop into the kind of phenomena that we see time and time again in terms of shootings, whether it be in Europe or the countless shootings that we have in this country. This is a result of hate that is directed against others. So it is, you know, it is an emotion that comes from self-loathing that is displaced to others, and that results in violence that is justified by all kinds of ideologies. There's been a lot of debate whether it's a hate crime or an act of terrorism, but actually the difference between the two is what kind of ideology is used to justify violence in order to redeem one's lost significance. Is it an anti-gay ideology, anti-LGBT ideology, or is it anti-Muslim ideology? But the function of ideology in both cases is to make it easier to engage in violence.
So you have written that terrorism is not a kind of psychopathology. And this surprises me because it would seem to me that if somebody is willing to kill large groups of people that they don't know who are most likely innocent, that would mean that person is insane. Does it not?
No, it does not. It is something that anyone can be capable of under the right circumstances. Look, we engage in war when we feel that the war is justified. We bomb cities. We suffer collateral damage of innocents. And that is because we feel that our actions are justified under the circumstances. So it is the ideology that interprets those activities as justifiable. In this particular case, you have a person. I'm not saying that a person who is deranged cannot become violent. Of course they can. But under some circumstances, when the society supports violence, when the ideology is in place that justifies violence, then anybody can who suffers from sense of loss of significance and is trying to redeem one's significance by doing something that is empowering would engage in violence.
If you're just joining us, my guest is psychologist Ari Kuglonski. We're talking about the effects of hate on the mind. We'd love to hear from you, your thoughts about hatred, whether it's something we can change in ourselves or combat as a people. Tweet us at OST Talk. You know, this is fascinating to me, Ari, and I wonder to what extent you're talking about people who feel as though their circumstances have changed or that they are in they feel themselves being disrespected. And I look back at all of the mass shootings that we have, a large majority of them, I think it's over 75%, have been committed by a young white male. And does that where hate enters in? Do we trace pathologies to find out that these are people who became enraged or experienced hate because they felt that something had been taken away from them?
In many cases, school shootings are usually perpetrated by individuals who felt that they are disrespected, they are bullied, they are nerds, that were overpowered by other more stronger individuals. It can be members of groups that feel that the United States has been taken over by forces that humiliate them and take away their significance as Americans. So, you know, it can be very personal circumstances of failure and humiliation, as probably was the case with Omar Mateen, or it can be a cases where you feel humiliated by virtue of the fact that your group was humiliated. So, for example, many young Muslims who join ISIS are a prey to the propaganda that Muslims in general were humiliated by the West, and they, as Muslims, feel the sting of that humiliation, and they feel that they ought to do something about it, redeem their lost honor, and join an organization whose ideology allows them to do so through violence.
But how, you know, here in the American soil, we have lost many more lives to young white males than we have to Muslim terrorists. So how do we detect that? For example, the threats that have been that were posted in social media to nightclubs, gay nightclubs in Atlanta. How do we take in some of these threats and say this is motivated by hate? This is not.
In many cases, it is motivated by hate, because to be violent against other people means that these others were culprits for some significant loss of personal meaning, humiliation, disrespect. So, you know, there are culprits of violence that are seen as guilty of harming oneself, whether this is objectively justifiable or not. These are people who are seen as guilty and deserving of violence. You know, we cannot eliminate failure and humiliation. Some people would be rejection sensitive. Some people would always feel that they do not receive their just desserts. Some people would feel that they ought to be respected to a greater extent than they actually are. So we cannot do much about that. This will always happen. What we can do something about is to strengthen the obstacles to the use of violence in the interest of redeeming their lost significance.
What obstacles are you talking about? Are you talking about access to firearms?
I'm talking about two types of obstacles. I'm talking of an ideological obstacle. We have to counter ideologies that are anti certain groups of people, racism, anti-LGBT, anti-Muslim, all kinds of ideologies that target people and allow and condone violence against those groups. So there's the ideological obstacle that once it's removed through these pernicious ideologies, allows the implementation of violence. And the second one is the gun culture that we have in this country, which includes not only the availability of guns, firearms, assault weapons, and what have you, but also the culture, the ideology that attaches to the use of guns, that the kind of Wild West ideology that we ought to, in a vigilante manner, be able to protect ourselves, that you know, we're kind of rough individualists who, with a gun, can face adversity, and this is justifiable, and this is moral.
Now, this suggests, Ari, that you feel that we can't do anything about the existence of hate, that some percentage of our population will always feel hatred toward another person or group.
That percentage can vary depending on whether the our system of government can be perceived by most people as just and satisfactory. So we should do our best to take care of the largest number of people in our ability. We should discriminate. We should fight discrimination, fight wage inequality, try to do the best we can to prevent suffering and the feeling of injustice by groups of people. But I think no matter how hard we try and how successful we are overall, there will always be some people who fall out of that distribution and out of that curve and would feel insignificance and failure. There's nothing that can be done about that. We can minimize the number of those people by having a just system of government that takes care of most people. But I think what we should do in our educational system, in our communities, in our media, is combat forcefully ideologies that condone violence and condone discrimination and racism, and also condone and also combat the gun culture that allows the physical obstacle on the obtainment of guns and their use in various ways to exist and to allow violence to spread.
That is Ari Kuglansky. He's a distinguished professor of psychology at the University of Maryland. Ari, thank you so very much.
My pleasure.
This is On Second Thought. We'd like to take just a moment to correct something reported on this show last month. We responded to some criticism from a listener named John Sugg following a segment about the Church of Scientology's new facility in Metro Atlanta. Sugg is a writer for the magazine Freedom, which is published by the church. However, we stated that Sugg is also a Scientologist. That fact is not confirmed. This correction also appears at our website, gpbnews.org. Republican lawmaker Renee Unterman once led efforts to shut down the Medicaid expansion in Georgia. Those efforts were successful. Now the state senator has changed her mind. Georgia's stance on the Medicaid expansion has cost the state billions in federal dollars, thousands of jobs, and possibly caused several hospitals to shut down. It's also forced large hospitals like Grady Memorial to absorb the costs of helping the poor, uninsured, and mentally ill. A new book traces the history of urban hospitals and how public policies have failed them. It's called A Spirit of Charity, Restoring the Bond Between America and Its Public Hospitals. Author and journalist Mike King joins me now. Mike, welcome.
Thank you, Celeste, for having me here.
What is the difference between an urban hospital and a rural hospital? Is it just a concentration of population?
Yeah, mostly I would say that's the case. Interestingly, both of them have a large population of uninsured and Medicaid patients, particularly in the rural areas where there is no competing hospital. So they have to absorb a large percentage of their patient mix is either uninsured or with Medicaid. In an urban hospital, that number is just multiplied by many times over. The difference between an urban hospital and a rural hospital is urban hospitals have competing hospitals around them that take in a lot more of the insured patients and Medicare paid for patients. So the risk in the urban hospital setting is much higher, I think, even than in rural hospitals.
Although here in Georgia, at least, I think most of the hospitals that I've actually had to shut down were rural hospitals.
That's correct. That's correct. I think there's been a number of them in just the last 4 years, something like 15 since the 2001.
Yeah, there's a concern that some people are quite a distance away from their closest hospital here in the state.
The rural hospital situation in this state is pretty complicated, and as it is around the country, clearly Medicaid expansion would help those hospitals to at least get a significant portion of the patients that they are treating now covered by an insurance plan of some kind. But it's much broader than just the Medicaid question for many rural hospitals. The areas that they serve are just simply not big enough to be able to support.
Or with enough patients, I guess. Yeah. Okay, so then let's bring that back to the urban environment. Does the Medicaid expansion make the difference for a hospital like Grady?
It does. When you stop and think about Grady's patient pay mix, and that's a term a lot of... Patient pay mix is a term that...
That just means the number of people who either I have insurance or don't,
it's
right?
It's who's in there, yes, the patients who are in there. And in most hospitals, the patient pay mix of uninsured and Medicaid patients is somewhere around 15%. At Grady, it's above 50%.
I want to repeat those. At most hospitals, the number of uninsured are people who are on Medicaid, 15.
Right.
At Grady, it's above half.
Correct.
That's huge.
Yeah, it's a big deal because if you don't find enough paying customers, in other words, those patients who are coming in with private insurance or Medicare to offset the cost of the patients who are coming in without insurance or without Medicaid or with Medicaid, then you're going to have a financial bind right off the bat. And that's where Grady is right now. It has always been that way. It's always been in that situation. And that's what one of the reasons why it got in such trouble back in the 2007, 2008 when it was on the brink of insolvency.
Okay, so then let's go back to the founding of Grady. What was the purpose of the hospital? Because it did have fairly bipartisan support, and it was not a small task to create that hospital.
No, Grady was a hospital that was created in the 1880s when the small not-for-profit hospitals, the first hospital in Atlanta was St. Joseph's Hospital, founded by the Sisters of Mercy in 1880. And there were several other hospitals that grew up that were not nonprofit sort of charity organizations. But as the city grew, they could not keep pace with the number of patients that were coming in. So the city fathers, mostly on the behest of the business community, interestingly, because that's who saved the Grady Hospital in 2007, 2008, the business community was pushing Atlanta to do what other major urban areas around the country were doing, which was to create a public hospital that was chartered in a way that the city provided some support to be able to provide charity care for anybody who needed it, who came through the door. So that's how Grady was
from the beginning. It was a charity hospital, which thus the title of your book is Spirit of Charity.
Yeah, the if you look at the ordinance that created it, I looked at it at the Atlanta History Center. It's a fascinating thing because it says the city of Atlanta commits to supporting Grady Hospital, as it says. And then in the original notes on the ordinance, it says as a charitable trust. And then that was removed at one point. But it still committed the city to supporting the hospital and its operations. And then, of course, the city had it for years and years, and then it became a Fulton and DeKalb Hospital Authority Hospital back in the 40s.
Which means what? What's that? When that change went, when no longer under the auspices of the city of Atlanta, what changed? What did that change mean?
I think it changed mostly because under Georgia's constitution, counties are responsible for health issues, and the city was supporting it by itself. it was getting a lot of patients from both Fulton and DeKalb County anyway. The city was saying, well, they need to pay for some of this freight. So at the time, they were able to get the two counties to agree to establish a hospital authority. The other thing it allowed it to do was to issue bonds, which is no big
deal. Yeah, that's no small thing, yeah.
And at the time, they transfer the hospital from the city to the bi-county authority took place.
All right. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist and author Mike King. His new book is called A Spirit of Charity, Restoring the Bond Between America and Its Public Hospitals. And we would love to hear from you. I wonder if you have questions about the Medicaid expansion in Georgia or about Grady itself. You can reach us. Tweet us now at OST Talk, and I promise you I will see the tweet. Mike, help me get my head around then about the effects of the turning down this Medicaid expansion. Do we have an idea of what the total amount is that Grady has lost because of that?
We don't have a total amount for Grady or individual hospitals because it's hard to actually pinpoint that. What we know from the law, from the 2010 Affordable Care Act law, is that Georgia was designated to get on the order of about $32 to $33 billion over a 10-year period. If you translate that, yeah, that's 1.5 times the state's budget right now. So if you translate that into a daily or a yearly amount, we're turning down about $9 million a day going back to the federal treasury because we have this ideological opposition to Obamacare simply on the basis that we just don't like anything associated with Obamacare.
And by that, you're referring to the legislature, although yeah. It sounds as though opinion may be turning on that.
I think opinion will turn on that. It's, you know, we have made this ideological stand. I think as soon as President Obama's in the rearview mirror, and particularly if there's a Democrat in the White House after he leaves, the state will all of a sudden get smart and decide that there's a way to create a plan that looks like Medicaid expansion. We won't call it Medicaid expansion. We'll call it something else, and we'll begin to take that money. The problem is, in the meantime, in the first 3 years of Obamacare, the federal government provided 100% of the funding for Medicaid expansion, and now it will begin to ratchet down to 90%.
Yeah,
so we will
off.
Have given up probably $3 to $5 billion over this stand.
But as you said, it only tapers off to 90%.
It does.
Which is still a huge amount.
The existing Medicaid program that has existed for a long time since the law was passed in 1965 is that the federal government provides about 65 or 66%. In order to encourage states to expand, the federal government, through Congress's act, decided to give them 100% in this particular case. And that's why those of us who were advocating for Medicaid expansion back after the law was passed, we're sort of stunned by the fact that the state was willing to give up 100% federal funding.
All right, let's return then to what has sort of complicated funding for Grady. And one of the arguments that you make in your book is stereotypes, that our attitude toward public hospitals and charity care has changed dramatically. What do you mean?
Well, I think all of us see public hospitals for the essential services that they provide, like trauma care. In almost every major city in the United States, the public hospital is the trauma care center, as it is at Grady. So we all recognize that that's a valuable service, and we all know that if we're hurt in an accident, we'd like to be taken to Grady. But I think we forget what else goes on in those hospitals, how important those hospitals are for other essential services, and particularly to poor people. They are the safety net hospitals for poor people. But we also forget that inside those hospitals is incredible medicine being performed there at all sorts of levels. Grady, for instance, has one of the best neuroscience centers in the metro Atlanta area. If you are suffering from a stroke or you have a loved one suffering from a stroke, you want to get them to Grady because they have a wonderful program. They have a great cancer program. They've done a wonderful job over the last 20 years at reducing the disparity between poor and affluent patients, black and white patients in the detection and treatment of breast cancer, for instance. So I think there's a lot of wonderful things going on at Grady that people just don't know about. They still have this perception that because it's a poor people's hospital, there's probably not a high quality of care going on there. And that's simply false. It's a great hospital in a lot of ways.
How does this become complicated then as over the decades our mental health facilities have sort of deteriorated?
Well, mental health care in this country is probably our worst public health policy failure at every level, not just.
Now, why do you call it a policy failure?
Because I don't think we've ever really made a commitment to figuring out how to treat poor people with chronic mental illness. We used to put them in warehouse state facilities. We deinstitutionalized those facilities in the 60s and 70s. We turned that, what was supposed to be moving them out of institutional care into community care, into a way of saving money instead of actually doing what we should have done. So we put these patients in the community without the support network necessary to be able to keep them well. And so the result is, I think you see a lot of these folks on the streets these days in the homeless population, and you certainly do that. You certainly see that here in Atlanta, and I think that's true in every big city in the country.
And one of the things you talk about is that that's basically just shifting the cost, because that ends up being a problem for law enforcement. It ends up being a problem for social services. It doesn't save us any money.
Correct. You move the cost from state hospital care down to making Grady absorb the cost for the emergency treatment of patients who are acting out and need immediate help. Are you warehouse them in the prisons or in the county jails? There's one estimate that about 40 to 45% of every inmate in a county jail in the United States of America is mentally ill.
And putting somebody in jail or in prison is incredibly expensive, even more expensive than a hospital stay.
Yeah, in fact, there's a chapter in the book about one of the programs that seems to really work is a concerted effort by a team of psychiatric social workers, psychiatrists, addiction specialists, and others to work with patients very individually. It's a very, I guess I would call it very concentrated effort on a team's part to work with patients. And if you can be with them two or three times a week to make sure they're taking their meds, make sure their housing situation is okay, they're going to be able to stay much more stable. Without that, they run the risk of recycling through either the jail system or Grady Hospital Psychiatric Ward.
So how precarious is Grady's situation at this point?
Grady's in much better shape than it was in 2007 and 2008 when it was on the brink of insolvency. Yeah. The new governance model that they created in 2007 and 2008 is working very well. They're much more financially stable than they were, but they're still very heavily dependent on foundation and philanthropic support to be able to expand their facility. Almost all of the capital expenditures at Grady over the last 8 years have come by virtue of the Marcus Foundation, Woodruff Foundation. Pete Carell and his wife have donated a lot of money there, the Avon Foundation. So the actual support it gets from Fulton and DeKalb County has, as a percentage of its overall budget, declined significantly over the last 20 years.
Which is a huge departure from its founding.
Correct.
So at this point, you were talking about the fact that turning down the Medicaid expansion is costing the state $9 million a day?
$9 million a day.
Would that be the gap for Grady?
It would certainly make a huge difference.
Would it solve the funding?
I don't think so completely. I think Fulton and DeKalb, like every other major governmental entity around urban areas, will still have to put up a portion of that funding. Medicaid would help considerably. The thing that would help the best, actually, is a universal health system of some kind enacted by the United States. We have yet to get there. We've taken a step in that direction with the ACA in 2010. But if everybody who came through those hospital doors had some form of insurance, then the hospital, of course, would be much more financially stable.
And in the minute that we have left, the argument you're making is that the change in funding of our hospitals actually indicates a change in our attitude toward care of our citizens.
I think that's true. And when we go through these tumultuous reform efforts like we did in 2010, 2012, we seem to think that we've solved these issues, but we're a long way from solving these issues.
Mike King is a journalist and author of the new book, A Spirit of Charity, Restoring the Bond Between America and Its Public Hospitals. Mike, interesting. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is On Second Thought. The Triumph of Peace sits prominently in Atlanta's Piedmont Park. The statue features a woman at rest on her side, hand thoughtfully on her chin. The model who inspired this sculpture and countless other works of art around the world is Audrey Munson. Her identity was unknown and her work went uncredited for years, but author James Bone recently documented the life of the mysterious model in his book, The Curse of Beauty, the scandalous and tragic life of Audrey Munson, America's first model.
The story of Audrey Munson is in plain view. You can see her story all around you, and you don't know you can see it. And once you do see it, you can't forget it.
Bone stopped by a studio in the United Kingdom to share a little of Munson's captivating story.
Pretty much until her 40th birthday, Audrey Munson lived with her mother. And her mother was a stage mother. Audrey Munson went to live in Providence, Rhode Island. She went to Catholic school, and it was one of those schools where the nuns would teach you to sing and dance. And so she learned to sing and she learned to dance. She learned to play instruments. And her mother pushed her onto the stage. And as a young girl in her mid-teens, the mother and daughter moved to New York City where she was a chorus girl. And it was while Audrey Munson, age 17, was a chorus girl on Broadway. Actually, she appeared in one of her early productions, in the first production that Al Jolson appeared in.
And when my work is done, coming home to the setting sun, from the gate he'll start to run, and then I'll kiss my boy.
And it was while she was a chorus girl, obviously a very beautiful young woman, that she was window shopping with her mother on Fifth Avenue, and they noticed a strange man following them. And the mother was a bit miffed at this and pulled her daughter into a store to try and shake the man, and the man just waited outside. So finally, the mother, Kitty, went outside and confronted this man, said, "Well, why are you following my daughter?" And the man very politely doffed his hat and said, "Well, excuse me, madam, I don't mean to embarrass you, but I'm a photographer." Now, if somebody did that to you these days in New York, first of all, about half the population of New York, as far as I can figure out, are photographers, you would probably run a mile. But in those times, and that was in 1909, photographers were a rarity. And this man was actually quite a prominent photographer of that era. And so Audrey Munson started posing for all of the leading artists of the day. And she posed not just for sculptors. She posed for tapestries, for book illustrations, for stained glass, for magazines. Because she was an artist model, she could get away with posing nude. And so in 1915, in a film called Inspiration, she became America's first naked movie star, the first American movie star to appear fully naked on screen. And that was a real landmark. And of course, she became very popular. The trade press advised the theatre owners that on the final day of the run, they should call out the police, because they said otherwise the gentlemen who aren't admitted to the sold-out show will riot. So that gives you an idea of how popular she was. She then got involved with the rich set in New York and Newport, Rhode Island. She had slowly worked her way up from very humble boyfriends through richer and richer and richer boyfriends until she finally got involved with the richest bachelor in America at the time, who was somebody called Herman Ulrich Jr., enormously wealthy young man, and she had a very unhappy relationship with him, because I discovered Herman Ulrich Jr.'s love letters to a ballet dancer in Paris. And it was a male ballet dancer. And Herman Ulrich Jr., it turns out, like his friend Cole Porter, who wrote the song Anything Goes, was a closet homosexual. And in fact, they both had an affair with this same male ballet dancer in the same year, 1925. And so when you hear that song, Anything Goes, there's quite a backstory to that song.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was a look thought of something shocking, but now God knows anything goes. Good offers to.
So Audrey Munson then had an extremely unlucky turn of events when, on her 40th birthday, her mother had her committed to a lunatic asylum. She had become increasingly paranoid. She had become increasingly agitated. And so the most perverse present from a mother to a daughter on her 40th birthday was to commit her to a lunatic asylum.
Who's in their hearts? But when I think of you, another shower star.
Audrey Munson spent an incredible 65 years in that lunatic asylum. She was there until her death in 1996 at the age of 104 years old.
Into each life some rain must fall, but too much is falling in mine.
We can still see Audrey Munson in our daily lives, the way she transforms the way you look around you and opens your eyes to all of these things that we just ignore in our daily lives. So next time you're in Piedmont Park and you're looking at the Peace Monument, you think of this story about Audrey Munson and you won't see it in the same way.
James Bone is the author of The Curse of Beauty, The Scandalous and Tragic Life of Audrey Munson, America's First Model. Journalist Jared Yates had just a handful of Twitter followers at this time last week. Then he made the decision to live tweet from a Donald Trump rally in Greensboro, North Carolina. His stream of messages conveyed a surreal nature at the event. Rampant misogyny, discrimination, hateful speech. Those tweets caused a stir on social media. Yates went from 1,400 followers to 15,000 in 3 days. He now has more than 17,000 followers. Jared Yates is an assistant professor of creative writing at Georgia Southern University, and he joins us now to share his story. Hi, Jared.
Hi, good morning.
Also with us is Chris Grant. He's a political science professor at Mercer University. Welcome back, Chris.
Nice to be here, Celeste.
And Jared is joining us via Skype. So, Jared, this was the rally in North Carolina was not the first Trump rally you had attended. Why were you going to those rallies?
I've been reporting on this election, and I've actually been very surprised to find that the atmosphere at these Trump rallies are completely different than anything I've ever seen from another political rally. The last one that I actually went to was the night that he announced his proposed Muslim ban, and I saw some pretty startling things at that rally as well. And I wanted to see what had happened, what would happen necessarily to those events now that he's the presumptive nominee.
So are you going to other rallies? Are you going to Bernie rallies and Hillary Clinton rallies as well?
Yes, that's right. I've been to a couple of Bernie rallies, and I actually went to Hillary Clinton's rally in Iowa.
Okay, and so for people who have not been following your tweet feed, can you describe some of the things that you saw that were of concern?
Absolutely. The thing that I think has garnered the most attention is twofold. One, very early on in the program, when a speaker mentioned Hillary Clinton, Secretary Hillary Clinton, a man behind me called her a misogynistic slur, which led to a smattering of laughter in my section of the crowd. What happened after that, I actually feel like was a response. It was someone nearby who I think was emboldened by that response, actually said when another speaker called for unity with the LGBTQ community following the Orlando massacre, another person in front of me actually shouted, "The gays had it coming." I think that they thought it was some type of joke or some kind of like tension breaker or something like that. But I believe those were the two worst things that I saw at the rally. There was a lot of intimidation of protesters. There was a chant of "kill them all" when it came to the media that was covering the rally. And then afterwards, on the way out of the building...
Wait, that's you. You're part of the media covering the rally, correct?
That's correct.
Did you feel unsafe?
I felt unsafe because I actually saw a protester who was being actively intimidated. It was obvious that he was a protester in the crowd, and there had been an earlier protester who had interrupted the program, and he was very obviously nervous and worried, and the crowd actually coalesced around him and started physically intimidating him, and it was at that moment that I felt very alone and very out in the open that it could possibly happen to me.
Okay, Chris, let me bring you into this conversation. Is what we're, and this is not the first coverage of Trump rallies in particular. Some news organizations have given their reporters special training in how to stay safe during some of these rallies because they've been violent. There have been violent clashes between protesters even. Is this unusual, or have we seen this at other points in our political history?
Well, I think you'd have to go back about 50 years to the Vietnam War protest and the 68 Democratic Convention to see something of this magnitude. There has been a theme that has gone on in American politics for many, many decades, that there are those that are on the inside and there are those that are on the outside, and that the people on the outside are outside because they've been pushed aside from what they rightfully deserve. And I think really what happens in the Trump rallies is that not only do we say to the outsiders, you should be on the inside, but you have the right to push the folks away that have gotten your place without reason, without deserving it. And so I think that's part of what's going on. There's license that is given, particularly by the candidate, to do that. I've been to Ted Cruz rallies, who demonizes the media and talks all sorts of nonsense about the media. I've been to Mike Huckabee rallies. And they do some of the same things, but they don't give license to make it individualized. And I think Trump does.
So, Jared, since that has occurred, I mean, we mentioned how many thousands of Twitter followers you've picked up, but some, not all of them have been supportive.
That's correct. Actually, yesterday I received the first smattering of death threats. I've received a pretty
Smattering of death threats.
Mm-hmm.
Do you take those seriously?
I like to think that these are just sort of sad people lashing out. But there's still a part of me that has to take that seriously, I think, with consideration to my safety.
What about that, Chris? When have we seen... actually, my senior producer just says he now has more than 19,000 followers in less than a week's time. But Chris, are we seeing something different in terms of the relationship with media, with journalists covering these rallies?
Well, I saw this in 2000, 2004, and 2008, where some of the candidates, particularly those that were trying to feed into this sentiment that I've been pushed aside, blaming the media first in primary. I mean, if you listen to some conservative talk radio, you'll hear the lamestream media. Public radio certainly gets tagged in that kind of rhetoric. And so that's a part of the rallying cry. You've been pushed aside. They're not telling you the truth. They're bad. What I haven't seen before is sort of the personal venom directed at individual reporters that Donald Trump gives. I mean, he'll point people out and say, that one right there. And that to me leads to a different level of and frustration that he's directing at an individual. And I think that when you make it ad hominem, when you make it individual, then there becomes a greater risk to an individual safety.
Do you then, Jared, plan to attend more rallies?
The unfortunate thing is I actually think that I'm not going to be able to go to any Donald Trump rallies after this. The angle that I've been taking
lately... Is that because people know you now?
Yeah, I believe so. I've gained enough attention that I think that I'm not going to be able to go in there sort of quietly. My main tactic so far in covering these elections has been to go into the crowd and from an observer standpoint. And I actually think that this, though the success has been nice, I actually think that this is probably going to keep me from being able to do that again.
But that's a Trump rally. Do you plan to go to other rallies while you continue covering the election?
Oh, absolutely. I'm planning on going to every rally I possibly can, and I'll be covering the conventions next month.
And then what do you use from these rallies to teach with? What lessons are you both taking away from them and then passing on to students?
I think that's an excellent question. One of the things I think that this sort of poison discourse that we're seeing on a public level now, I really want my students to understand discourse. I really want my students to understand respectful conversation and actually empathy. I'm actually a creative writing professor, and so I actually think the basis of that entire endeavor is the idea of empathy. And I think that this we can learn from as much what it's not as what it is.
So, Chris, in the minute that we have left, what do we, as journalists and as political science professors, what do we take away from this?
Well, I think we need to understand why people feel outside the system, and we need to understand some of their concerns, very much what Jared was saying. But we also need to understand that our democracy is based on mutual respect. And if we don't have that, we fall apart. We lose this fantastic form of government that we have.
Okay. Jared, as you do you plan to then be careful about rallies that you attend? I mean, is there any other rally where you have felt unsafe as you did in North Carolina?
The rally after Mr. Trump announced his proposed Muslim ban, it got a little scary afterwards. There were actually violent threats against protesters, and I was outside covering that, and it was a very uncomfortable situation. But I'm planning on going into these like any journalist would, with an eye and a stare toward safety.
And okay, Jared Yates, I guess we're going to have to keep following to see what happens in future rallies. Assistant professor of creative writing at Georgia Southern University, author of the book "I Am the Oil of the Engine of the World," and Chris Grant is a political science professor at Mercer University. Jared and Chris, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's our show for today, but we would love to hear your stories about this kind of thing. Maybe it wasn't a political rally, but have you ever been to a large gathering of people like that? Maybe an outdoor concert or something else, and did you ever feel nervous or afraid in that large of a mass of people? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter. It's at OST Talk, or post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.